just puts me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
And on the last Abandoned Manitoba before Valentine's Day, it's time to welcome Gordon Goldsboro from the Manitoba Historical Society. And I mention that because we love having you on the show.
And I love being here.
There you go. Happy almost Valentine's Day. What do we talk about this week, Gordon?
We are talking about ashes.
Okay.
Ashes, well, from a really unusual source. The idea for today's topic arose several months ago when listener Jan McClelland contacted me with an odd little story she'd found in back issues of her local newspaper. It described what they called bomb ash at a small country school northeast of Deloraine that had occurred in April 1954.
Wow. Is this anything like the ash from forest fires that we saw like last summer and the last couple of summers?
Well, yeah, in principle, sure. But the source, I think, is very different. Instead of ashes drifting down from burning trees in northern Canada, these particles were said to have come from an explosion that had taken place 7 weeks earlier in the South Pacific Ocean. It was, in fact, one of the most famous explosions in history. And its memory is preserved today in the name of a piece of clothing.
How so?
Okay, well, in the early 1950s, the United States and the Soviet Union, well, they were building up their nuclear arsenals. Both countries carried out underground and atmospheric test detonations. And when those tests occurred above ground, the products of the blast could travel, well, extraordinary distances. Radioactive materials such as cesium-137 were carried on high-altitude winds. Well, they were dispersed so widely that virtually no place on Earth escaped some degree of fallout. Now, one of those tests took place on a remote Pacific island chain called the Bikini Atoll. Now, on the 1st of March, 1954, the United States conducted its largest nuclear detonation at that point. It was an explosion so powerful that it literally vaporized three islands in the chain. It left a crater that you can see from space, and it sent a radioactive cloud 130,000 feet into the atmosphere. And this was only the largest of several tests that had been conducted at Bikini since 1946. Well, shortly after the first of those tests, French designer Louis Rayard unveiled a daring two-piece bathing suit, and he called it the Bikini. He wanted it to be as explosive and provocative as its namesake, and he succeeded.
Well, maybe to imply that the rest of the bathing suit was vaporized during a blast, maybe?
Well, it was abbreviated compared to bathing suits before, and that was what made it so daring, I think.
All in the name of world peace, of course.
Of course.
So how does the Bikini explosion in 1954 relate to ashes in southwestern Manitoba?
Well, by mid-April, several weeks after the detonation, motorists in Seattle, Washington began noticing tiny nicks appearing in their windshields. Each of those nicks was about a 32nd of an inch wide and about the same depth. And soon afterwards, similar reports of pitted glass came in from several communities in British Columbia, Alberta, even several eastern U.S. states. So it became a real phenomenon all over Western North America. Well, then, in the 22nd of April issue of the Deloraine Times, of course, a community newspaper in Deloraine, Manitoba, readers learned that schoolteacher Edna Wintle had driven her car to Bidford School. That was a one-classroom school northeast of Deloraine. And while she was inside the school, students came rushing in from recess to report that, well, the back windshield of her car suddenly crumbled inward. Well, because of the pervasiveness of these reports of pitting of glass, they immediately had a newspaper story that suggested maybe that broken windshield was the result of bomb ash that had weakened the windshield.
Good old Miss Wintle. Last week, you mentioned that you'd be talking about ash. I immediately remembered that at home, I have been sitting on something for a number of decades related to ash. I've talked about it once before on the show. And right here, I have a baggie
of
ash from Mount St. Helens.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know, you're a scientist. I'm just going to hand that over to you there. You check the consistency of that. Would you call that volcanic ash?
Oh, yeah. Very fine powder, a sort of a light gray color.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it gets sort of compacted, it can form, well, almost like concrete. It's not as hard as concrete, but it can certainly look sort of like concrete. And, yeah, that's what this looks like. But, of course, I have to ask, where did you get a bag of Mount St. Helens ash?
Well, it's interesting because I don't really remember. I used to have it in the back of my mind. Somebody that I knew went, I guess, to Washington State and brought some back. Mm-hmm. And I was super interested in, like, hey, I brought some volcanic ash back from Mount St. Helens. I'd love to see that. Well, I'll give you some.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've had this little bag. And you remember that before Ziploc bags, they were baggies.
Yeah.
They were actually called baggies.
Right.
They had an alligator on the box. This is a baggie. From way back when. But it says on here, volcanic ash, first major eruption in 20th century, 1980. Mount St. Helens.
So neat.
Very cool.
But the fact is that you wouldn't necessarily have had to go to Washington to get a bag of ash, because I think anyone who was alive at that time will remember that we here in Manitoba did experience some of the ash raining down on us. I remember at least for a day, I was working in Manitou at the time, and I remember walking outside and seeing it was sort of almost like the smoke in the air we saw last year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was cloudy, or it appeared to be cloudy for quite a long time, and it rained down, and yeah, it wasn't very thick on the ground, but you could definitely sweep some up, I think, and so it wouldn't surprise me if somebody could have taken a bag, collected it from a wide area, and put it in a bag.
Scooped it up.
Yeah, here in Manitoba.
Traveling, you know, thousands and thousands of miles, right?
Absolutely, and I think that's the thing about this ash story, is that it involves materials that transfer long distances, you know, and, you know, when you think about volcanic ash, you know, what it brings to mind for me anyways is some research that I did when I was living in Alberta back in the 1980s. You know, we were studying the region's prehistory, meaning the time before recorded, you know, things about the past, stories and facts and so on. You know, and we could basically reconstruct prehistory that went back thousands of years. We could understand the environment of Alberta, well, and other places too. And the way we did it was analyzing the sediments at the bottoms of Alberta lakes. The idea is a fairly simple one. You would collect a vertical core of lake sediments, and there's various techniques to do that. And that vertical core forms a natural timeline. The uppermost layer represents the most recent deposits of sediments that came down and landed on the bottom of the lake, you know, most recently. And the deeper you go in that core, the farther back in time you travel. And you can analyze these layers for various constituents, and it tells you something about the conditions that occurred in the lake, around the lake, and by inference, you know, in the region where the lake occurs. This technique is called paleolimnology. And it helps us to understand long-term environmental change. You know, if you want to know how is Canada going to change in the event of global climate warming, well, you can find out, because thousands of years ago, it was warmer than it is today. And we can say, well, it was like that then, and we can therefore predict what it'll be like in the future here. Virtually every Alberta lake we studied contained one or more chalky gray layers. Looks very much like your Mount St. Helens bag.
Right.
Somewhere along the length of that core. And these layers are called tephra. Tephra basically is a layer of volcanic ash, and it comes into the lake from a volcanic eruption that has occurred somewhere in the vicinity of the lake. And of course, because this ash can travel vast distances, as we know from Mount St. Helens, well, of course, it means that a lake in Alberta could have ash in it from an eruption that occurred in, you know, in the U.S. And in fact, when we were studying some of these lakes, we found that the very largest tephra layer came from a volcano in Oregon called Mount Mazama. And what happened was that about 7,700 years ago, Mount Mazama erupted with such force that the entire top of the mountain was blown into dust and ash, And, well, in fact, it's not a mountain anymore. Some listeners may have visited it. Today, that collapsed caldera that was left behind is known as Crater Lake.
So these layers of volcanic ash, is that useful information?
Oh, very much so. You know, if we know when a particular eruption occurred, well, we can then determine the age of the sediment layer in the core that is immediately adjacent to the tephra. So if we find a layer of Mount Mazama ash, we know that that eruption occurred 7,700 years ago. The layer immediately above that tephra is therefore just a little bit younger than 7,000 years. So it gives you a basis to know time. And that's so important when doing paleolimnology. You need to know what time period is represented by that core. This dating method is called tephrochronology, and it's an invaluable technique that we, you know, use when we're doing this kind of analysis. Unfortunately, because volcanic ash dissipates the further away from the blast you go, here in Manitoba, we're just too far away from most of the eruptions that have occurred. And yes, even though in 1980 with Mount St. Helens, we did get some ash here, it was just in too small a quantity to have formed a visible tephra layer. And therefore, none of the sediment cores that I've collected from Manitoba Lakes has contained tephra. We've had to rely on other dating techniques, such as radiocarbon analysis.
So coming back to that incident near Deloraine, so Miss Wintle's windshield damage, was it really caused by radioactive ash?
Well, I don't know if we'll ever know, because I don't think any scientific study was conducted on it. But to my knowledge, the other reports of the supposed nuclear fallout that was drifting across Western Canada in 1954 involved only pitting of the windshield glass, not the outright destruction of the windshields. And, you know, and how could ash cause a pane of glass to suddenly crumble inwards? You know, I just can't imagine a mechanism. And then the other thing is that there are few other accounts of similar damage. I mean, if it was so destructive as to cause that windshield to collapse, well, wouldn't there have been other windshields that collapsed as well? And I searched historical newspapers. I thought, oh, there'll be lots of other references to this sort of thing happening. And I found none. So I have to confess, I'm skeptical. I'm more inclined to think that that crumpled windshield was the result. Well, let's just say maybe there was an errant baseball.
I was just going to say.
The kids were out at recess. They were maybe having a game. The ball went flying in the wrong direction. It hit the teacher's windshield, crushed it, and then the kids went,
look what happened.
What are we going to do? We'll tell her that it was bomb ash. Yeah, that's it. Everybody's thinking about bomb ash. We'll tell her that's the problem.
Listen, better for you to say that than me. It's not up to CBC journalistic standards to just make that conclusion on my behalf there.
And I won't make it either. The fact is, we will never know, probably. But I do think that the widespread distribution of fallout from that 1954 test did become one of the early sparks for public opposition to atmospheric nuclear testing. It was demonstration that this stuff went far and wide. And do you really want radioactive material coming raining down from the sky? Well, no. You know, so,
no.
So even if that bomb ash reported at Bidford School near Deloraine had an entirely different explanation, and again, we won't know for sure, it does reflect the unease that people were beginning to feel about nuclear weapons, unease that lingers today, even in a skimpy bathing suit that still reminds us where its name came from.
With the yellow polka dots, perhaps, as well.
That's right.
Well, thanks for that, Gordon. What's up for next week?
Well, I've made the point here on Abandoned Manitoba that older buildings made from what I think are superior materials are every bit as green as ones built today with high-tech materials. However, there is a particular vulnerability in some old buildings that has surfaced in a few notable cases. Next week, we're going to consider three Winnipeg examples, one still standing, at least for now, and two demolished that all fell victim to the same underlying flaw.
Interesting.
But before we go,
okay.
I'd like our listeners to share their thoughts about items that were once common that are now largely unknown, at least to younger generations. Two examples that come to mind for me are toe rubbers. Do you remember those, Bruce?
Yeah.
Toe rubbers? Of course, men used to wear them over their shoes, and maybe a few men still do. Or how about frost shields?
Yes, that's one for sure.
That were found on car windshields in wintertime.
Everyone had them.
Everybody. And yeah. As far as I know, nobody does today. No. Well, here's the thing then. What else belongs on a list of things that younger people will have no knowledge of? I'd love to hear your suggestions. Send them to me at Gordon, G-O-R-D-O-N, at mhs.mb.ca. And if we get enough of them, they'll be the basis for a future episode of Abandoned Manitoba.
Frost shields for sure. All right. Thanks for that, Gordon.
Bye-bye for now.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba. Many moons.